Hi, this is Bob Emmons for Skidumpa Library's Owl Radio, and I'm talking to my friend and neighbor, Norman Saussure, who spent a lot of his working career overseas, and he's going to tell us a little bit about some of those experiences. Norman.
Hi, Bob. I've had four international living experiences. The first was based in Paris, France, from 1975 to 1977. I spent over 15 years in Paris on three separate occasions. I was first transferred there from Boston by my employer at the time, the accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers, as part of their international exchange program. I took the QE2 over and was met at the Paris train station by the gentleman I was transferred for, a Lebanese national who had just spent 18 months in Boston. I was wearing my brand new bell-bottom plaid pants at the time, for which I took a lot of good-natured kidding for a long time. The first night was spent at the home of this Lebanese colleague, along with his younger brother, who had just fled the Lebanese Civil War and had already lost some Maronite Christian friends. My first night in Paris was spent talking about this war between Christians and Muslims, which is still topical today. My first days were more cultural than professional. Not only were my French colleagues smiling at my clothes, but also at my Quebecois accent via Lewiston, Maine, and the fact that I didn't drink. All this changed in a hurry as my friend's wife took me shopping for a new wardrobe. My accent pretty much disappeared, and three colleagues and myself had three bottles of wine over lunch my first day on the job. I didn't really care for the wine and nearly fell asleep at my desk. After this, though, I had wine with lunch and dinner almost every day until returning to Boston 2 years later, and never got drunk. I ordered wine at my first lunch back in Boston, which shocked my colleagues who were drinking Coke, iced tea, or milk. It was the first and last time I had wine with lunch in Boston. Great food and wine were an everyday affair in Paris, and French cheese with every meal became an addiction. I had lunch one day at France's best cheese restaurant, where the choices all had a cheese theme, such as a cheese souffle to start, steak with a cheese sauce as the main course, and cheesecake for dessert. Or, with 100 available, just cheese, which is what I had, eating 35 different cheeses with a bottle of wine. The cheesemonger lined them up from mild to strong so as not to overwhelm the mild ones. Having grown up on Velveeta, this was paradise. I swore not to have cheese again for quite a while, but was back at it the next day. Some habits never change, though. Like many expats, I missed some things from home. What I missed most included Cheez-Its, which were unavailable in Paris.
I can testify to that. When Norman and I go fishing, he usually takes Cheez-Its with him.
So I would receive care packages from my family and friends who felt sorry for me and send them along. I'd have them with a glass of wine or two, watching old movies, such as John Wayne as the Ringo Kid in Stagecoach, speaking perfect French in the dubbed version. Most of my Paris clients were French subsidiaries of U.S. companies, such as Ford France, Firestone France, and Raytheon Europe. My first French client was a large chemical group which didn't want any Americans on their account. I was introduced as a French Canadian, which they liked. This went well until I was asked about my favorite restaurants in Montreal and Quebec City, but I'd never been there. I was able to dodge the question for a few days, buy a travel guidebook, speak with some Canadians, and have an answer for them. My most interesting client was not in France or Europe, but in Guinea, West Africa. Few Americans or Westerners went to West Africa, as this was not your typical tourist or business destination. Most would go to South Africa or East Africa, such as Kenya, or North Africa, such as Morocco. But countries such as Guinea or Benin or Mali or Burkina Faso or Sierra Leone were not part of the typical tourist itinerary. So I jumped at the opportunity. Guinea was run by a long-ruling Marxist dictator named Sékou Touré. I worked in Paris with a few Guineans who were in exile as part of the opposition to Mr. Touré. I arrived in Conakry, the capital, carrying what was probably illegal and dangerous, a copy of George Orwell's 1984, which was incredibly stupid. But I was lucky, as my luggage was being examined, which I wasn't expecting and was starting to panic, a Guinean official intervened to stop the infection as I was a guest of the government. Our client was the government, which was developing an iron ore mine in the interior in the East. Like many of these countries, Guinea was resource-rich but capital-poor. The development was being funded in part by Western companies who wanted the financials reviewed and certified by a Western firm. We were living in a compound with a pool, air conditioning, Western cuisine, Heineken beer for 30 cents, and a car and driver. We were surrounded by poverty. There was also a Russian naval base there, with Russians everywhere. We saw them on the beach doing their calisthenics stark naked, and at entertainment venues like the local theater, where they were seated in the front row as guests of honor, and we were sitting behind them. The entertainment one night was a heavy metal band and a play about a woman in love with a hippopotamus. The hippo died, and she was in tears. We flew to the interior in the country's only plane, a rickety Russian plane with a Russian pilot. The Russians, it seemed, did not give their good stuff away. I was sitting in the rear next to live caged chickens. We made it safely and were greeted by officials in new Japanese ATVs. We drove up the mountain past newly built villages, all clearly part of a development showpiece, with very friendly people. The visit inside the mine was fun but uneventful. I left Orwell's 1984 in the room I had. We returned to Conakry, then back to Paris. On a later trip, we presented our report with recommendations to the country's VP, a remarkably eloquent and elegant gentleman. With 6 weeks' vacation, I was able to travel to almost every European country. One memorable trip in February 1976 was to the Olympics in Innsbruck, Austria, where 37 countries over the world was competing. The top two medalists, of course, were the Soviet Union and East Germany, both no longer around, with the U.S. finishing third. The top event, the men's downhill skiing, was electric and won by Austria's own great Franz Klammer, who was a successor to France's Jean-Claude Killy. Another fun trip was to Oktoberfest in Munich, Germany. I went to one of the beer halls with an American friend from Lewiston and made many new best friends from Germany. We were at a table next to the Oompa Pa band, and I resisted the chance to go up and sing with the band, or dance on the table. This was a prize table, which was in fact owned, so to speak, by a group that returned every year and paid for the location. There was a bronze plaque on the table with the group's name on it. I returned to this same table 4 years later with another company, and the same people were there. They remembered me, and this time I did join the festivities. There were several visitors, too, to Paris, most memorably my saintly mother, who went to Mass every day in Lewiston. My sister was with her and convinced me that she would enjoy the world-famous cabaret at the Moulin Rouge, with great variety acts, but most famously, beautiful, semi-naked women dancing the can-can. I was embarrassed, but Mom loved it, and I was shocked. On the 4th of July, 1976, I got into a bit of a bother. During a service at the American Cathedral in honor of the U.S.'s 200th birthday, a group dressed as American Indians in war paint interrupted the service with chants and yelling. I grabbed one of them, picked him up, and carried him out of the church, and was soon joined by other Americans. The service went on. The American presence in Paris, by the way, was and continues to be in the many thousands. After 18 months, I planned my return to Boston the long way, flying east around the world. I took a 5-month leave of absence to do so, with stops in some 20 countries and 30 cities. Two of the stops were for business, for Raytheon in Tehran, Iran, and Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Raytheon was providing surface-to-air missile defense systems to both countries, the upgraded version of which, the Patriot, is still in use around the world today, in Israel and South Korea, for example. In 1977, Iran was ruled by the Shah. He fell less than 2 years later. But there was a large American presence in Tehran and heavy tension in the air even then. An American contractor had just been assassinated when his Iranian chauffeur was stopped and told to run away. Raytheon and other companies started taking defensive driving lessons and driving themselves. We got into a troubling accident there. Our car ran into another car, which hit another car. But we were lucky. The other two drivers started screaming at each other, and we just drove away. I was not unhappy to leave the country, as beautiful as it was, after just a week. In Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, we stayed on the Raytheon compound, where non-veiled ladies were allowed, and which was a mini-city with its own housing, restaurant, tennis courts, swimming pool, softball field, and so on. We visited the souk, or bazaar, in Jeddah, noticed beggars with no hands,
Did they have the hands amputated because they were thieves?
Yes, yes, that's what we were told. And there were several of them, because that's the crime under Islamic law.
Sure.
So that was an odd sight. The office buildings did not have women's toilet facilities. And most notably, we took a trip to Taif, the mile-high unofficial summer capital of the country in Mecca province, which was relatively cool. We had to take the non-Muslim bypass around Mecca to get there, but it was still an eventful trip. We saw a truck kill two camels and the camel owner beating up on the truck driver. We noticed that some soldiers in Taif went to lunch and did not return to work. We were followed very closely back to Jeddah by a car not more than 2 feet behind us on a wide-open road. We were told about a woman who drove her very ill husband to the hospital and was arrested because she wasn't allowed to drive, and her husband died shortly after that. After this, I resumed my trip to Boston via the east, not knowing that I would return to Saudi Arabia in a year or so on a five-month assignment for Raytheon, which was my second international living experience, and also returned to France on two other occasions, which we can talk about at another time. So thanks for listening, and Bob, thanks for asking me to say a few words.
My pleasure, Norman. Thank you very much. This is Bob Emmons for Skanopa Libraries HAL Radio.